Amen. Okay, so the reason I got you guys to watch that video again this evening was because although I'm not officially doing something from the Frontline series, it's really important that we remind ourselves that we are called to the front line. Very often, people think that when you're called to the front line, it means you're supposed to go out to Burundi or to go out to a tribe that have never met Jesus before, or to go and do something amazing, like Callan Andrew White in the Middle East, who has got an amazing job of trying to bring about reconciliation between different faith groups, Shia Muslim, Sunni Muslim, Jew, and all the other groups in the Middle East who are at each other's throats at the moment. And you say, well, as I'm not doing that, as I'm just going to work and sitting in an office and doing the boring old spreadsheets, or folding up bits of paper and stuffing them in envelopes, or taking the kids to school, I don't actually have a front line to go to. But the point is, you are called to the front line. I think there's an important distinction that we need to know, though. There are many preachers who will give you a sermon like this. It's a bit like when Lord Kitchener put up the signs in 1914 and 15, which said, your country needs you, Kitchener needs you. And if you didn't go to the front line, ladies would give you white feathers that said, you're a coward. And sometimes Christian preachers who really want to inspire people to go out are guilty of doing something similar. And they will preach a sermon that goes like this. God needs you. Jesus has a plan which only you can do. And if you don't go, how can anybody else go? And God's plan won't work because you were too scared to do anything. Well, actually, that's not true. Jesus needs you? He does. But actually, he doesn't. It's a bit like Peter Guinness's on the other hand theology, which he's often talked about in Jewish thinking. On the one hand, yes, Jesus has a plan, something only you can do. On the other hand, actually, you're not doing God a favor by going. You're not doing something which only you can do because God can't do it any other way. God can do it himself, no problem at all. But he wants us to go. He wants to use us because he wants to share our whole life with us. And that is not going to happen if we sit quietly, do nothing, and just use God to give us things when we want them, or to help us when we have a problem. That's trying to use God as some sort of glorified Father Christmas. And while it's nice to have a glorified Christmas, Father Christmas, and while some preachers would like you to believe that God is a glorified Father Christmas, he is anything but a glorified Father Christmas. He wants us to step out onto the front line because by doing that, we will get a chance to know what kind of God we really follow. We will get a chance to be his eyes, his ears, his hands, his feet. What I want you to take away from this, even if you miss the rest of everything else I say, it's that God calls you to the front line because by going, it's the only way that we can get to know the God we really worship. Because he will come with us and he'll go with us all the way. So, we get back to the story of Moses. Moses was actually in a very good position when God spoke to him. Sometimes people have this idea that Moses was a refugee and had lost everything. Well, yes, he had. He wasn't the prince of Egypt anymore. He wasn't the son of Pharaoh, who was revered by everybody and might succeed him one day. That was the height which he fell from when he left Egypt. But he had fallen in with a high priest of Midian. A high priest is greatly revered in a tribe. So he was in a very good position and he had a very good job. He looked after the flock of his father-in-law, the high priest of Midian, and he'd set off with them across the desert. It could have been an awful lot worse. He had a good position. Sometimes we're in good positions too, when God decides it's time to give us a nudge. And he gave Moses a nudge by showing him a burning bush. Why a burning bush? A bush on fire isn't that unusual in the desert. Things do catch fire. And fire is a frightening thing. Even now, we have insurance against fire damage. All sorts of buildings have fire doors, which block off the fire when the door is closed. That's to protect you from fire. Even today, with everything we have, fire is dangerous. In the ancient times, when Moses lived, fire was even more dangerous. If fire got out of control, your whole town could go up in smoke. You had to be very careful how fire was lit to ensure that didn't happen. But it was also the thing that kept you alive in the desert when it was cold at night. So the ancients saw fire as something very special. There was a god of fire. That is why God appeared to Moses in a burning bush. Because fire was something people saw as a powerful and a mystical thing, and something which provided you with life at the same time. So a bush on fire isn't unusual, but when Moses sees it, a bush on fire, okay, that's nothing unusual, except that it's not wilting. Fire destroys things. You put a piece of wood on a fire, it burns, and it's destroyed. It turns into ash, and you need to put more wood on the fire to keep the fire going. But now you have a bush which is on fire, but it looks normal. There's nothing different about it, except there are flames pouring out of it. So like everyone else, Moses goes over to have a closer look. And often we say, well, I want a burning bush, and I haven't got a burning bush, so I think I'll just carry on as I am, thank you very much. I'll stay with my boring old spreadsheets. Maybe our burning bush isn't something as unusual as Moses' burning bush. Maybe the burning bush which God shows us is a colleague who looks down or who looks miserable. Excuse me, could someone raise the lectern a bit? It's a little bit low. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's lovely. Let go. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you very much. Yeah, just need to be able to read my notes. Okay. Maybe our burning bush is a colleague who looks a bit miserable. Maybe our burning bush is a kid in tears in the classroom where we work. And our call is step out of the comfort zone, go over to that person and find out what's wrong. And our response is just like Moses' one. Not me, thank you. I've got these boring old spreadsheets to do. A minute ago, they were boring. Now, we want to stay with them, thank you, because if we can stay with our spreadsheets, or stay at our desk, or stay with the job we're doing, we get to stay in our comfort zone and things carry on exactly as they were before. Unfortunately, God doesn't see it that way. As far as God is concerned, we have a mission and he wants to start using us. So when Moses hears that he's meant to go and rescue the Israelites, he's very pleased that God has seen the oppression of the Israelites. He's overjoyed that God has decided it's time to lead them into a land of milk and honey. And even if it's going to be a land that's full of other tribes, well, that shouldn't be real trouble, because it is the God of his fathers, after all, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. But what? You're sending me? Oh no, not me, thank you. I skipped over the rest of the conversation which Moses has with God, because it really is long. But basically, first God says, go and save the Hebrews and I'll go with you. Moses says, no, I'm not great. Then it's, I don't know who you are. Then it's, I can't speak. Then it's, what if they don't believe me? And even though God shows him all sorts of miracles, three miracles to do, throw down a stick, it turns into a snake. Put your hand into your pocket, it comes out covered with leprosy. Put it back in your pocket, it turns normal. Throw down a mug of water, it turns into blood. And Moses still doesn't want to go. He argues with God and says, no, thank you, I don't want to go. Even though it's a direct call to the front line. Now, here's the really interesting thing. The world wouldn't see it the way God sees it. The world would do a Kitchener on you and say, you're a coward for not going. How can you say you won't go? How often in films do we see the hero being vilified because he won't go until he changes his mind and goes? Have you noticed God doesn't do that? Instead of getting angry with Moses immediately and telling him to do as he's told, which is what he had every right to say, after all, he is the God of the universe and we are people, he gave Moses answers to his questions. If you were saying, I can't go, it's too big, God says, no, it is too big, but I'm going with you, so go. Look at the people God uses, if you don't believe me. Gideon says, oh, I don't want to fight the Midianites, I'm frightened of them, I'm scared. God says, I am with you, you brave, strong man. And you read that and go, you are having a laugh, aren't you? Call him a brave, strong man. I've seen a dog that was braver. God goes to Jeremiah, I want you to speak to the Israelites and tell them to come back to me. No way, God, I'm much too scared. Anyway, I'm only a child, I don't know how to speak. God says, I'll teach you how to speak. Here, I'll touch your mouth. Now go. In the world stories, it's different. In the Quran, Moses says to God, oh, I'll go, and I'm not a very good speaker, so if you would heal that and make me into a good speaker so I can do it even better, I'll go right now. That's what we would like, but it's not what we get in the Bible. But it should be comforting that that's what we get in the Bible, because God says, I will go with you. I will come with you. I will teach you what to say. In other words, he's not saying, off you go, here's your mission. I'll be waiting to see how well you do, and I'll be there to tell you off if you're doing it wrong. He actually says, I'm coming too. Wherever God calls us, and wherever he sends us, whether it's away from our boring old spreadsheets to the colleague who's in tears, to talk to the child who you know has a poor home situation, or to have a chat with the person on the table opposite who's got no one sitting with them and looks pretty lonely, he will go with you. If it's too big, that's fine. We worship a great big God, as the song goes. At some point, however, we have to stop arguing with God and decide whether what we're doing is just plain disobedient, or are we asking legitimate questions? Moses' argument with God rather set the tone of the relationship which we see between Moses and God from then on. God said, I'm sick of the Israelites. I'll make you into a great generation. Now leave me alone so I can destroy them. And Moses said, no, you promised that you would make the Israelites into a great generation. It happens right across the Bible. The psalmists say to God, how can you let this happen? How can you do this when they're in trouble? When the son of a widow dies, he was taking care of Elijah. Elijah doesn't say, oh, don't worry, God has a plan. He'll bring him back to life. Instead, Elijah says to God, how could you let that happen? How could you do that when she was protecting me? When she was sheltering me and you sent me to her? How can you let that happen? You are allowed to question God. But at some point down the line, it becomes clear what God wants you to do. You have to stop arguing, and you have to decide whether you're going to obey or whether you won't. That's why eventually God got quite cross with Moses and said, "What about Aaron? He's a good speaker. Send him with you. He's coming to meet you anyway. Why doesn't Aaron go with you? And I'll go with both of you." Now, if any of you have seen the film Prince of Egypt by Steven Spielberg, it's a really great film. But here is a bit that Steven Spielberg gets completely and utterly wrong. Moses didn't go to Egypt by himself. Moses didn't go to Pharaoh by himself. Aaron went as well. The world likes this idea of one brave man going out on his own to do A, B, C, and D. Or in today's generation, where rightly people admit that everyone can be brave, it's one girl who goes out to do A, B, C, and D all by herself, bravely taking a stand against whatever. And often their sidekick is there to carry their bags, or to not understand the deduction of the detective, so the detective can really show off and explain to the poor silly what's-it how clever they are. Let's be honest, that is how Sherlock Holmes does it. That is how many great detectives do it. You've all seen it. The inspector's worked it all out, and the sergeant is pretty clueless and is still going, "I still don't get it," right up to the end. Aaron and Moses were equal partners in what they were doing. Aaron did the talking. Moses did the miracles. I often think, because it says Moses and Aaron stood before Pharaoh, people assume that Moses did the talking. Actually, I think there was probably a bit of a duet going on. Aaron spoke to Pharaoh. Moses spoke to Aaron, and Aaron spoke to Pharaoh again. Or maybe sometimes Moses spoke to Pharaoh, and sometimes Aaron spoke to Pharaoh. We won't know, because we weren't there. And the Bible doesn't tell us who said what to who. The important thing is, Aaron was not there just to carry Moses' bags. Aaron was there to help him and be an equal partner. If you are called to go out somewhere on the front line and you feel you can't go it alone, that's because you're not supposed to. Find someone who you can say, "I'm really scared about this," to. And that person can then say, "You know what? I'm terrified too. Why don't we pray together?" Or have someone to whom you are accountable. If you haven't got a Christian working right with you in what you're doing, have someone who will pray with you. Have someone who can give you advice. Because if you try to do it on your own, it's very difficult to know when you're doing it wrong. It can be hard to detect what God is saying when you're doing it by yourself. That's why you need someone else to come along too. And lastly, here's the really amazing thing. It wasn't just Moses and Aaron. It was God, Moses, and Aaron. God didn't say, "I'm sending Aaron with you because obviously you don't trust me enough." Actually, Moses didn't trust God enough. That's why he was saying, "I don't want to do it." Instead of saying, "Oh, fine, go with Aaron then. I'll wash my hands off you," God said, "I'll go with both of you. I'll teach you both what to say." When you are called to the front line, you must have God going with you. If you don't, it doesn't matter if you find someone who believes in you completely, who comes with you, it will still fail. To illustrate this point, I'll tell you a little story. Everybody knows the tale of Martin Luther King Jr. But the bit I didn't know until recently was that he never really wanted to be part of the civil rights movement. He had this idea when he left college and became a preacher, he would have a nice quiet life, reading lots of theological books, playing with his children, living with his wife, teaching in his church, and that would be that. Then what happened? Rosa Parks happened. Dr. King was asked to chair a protest about the fact that black people in America were required to stand in a bus and give up their seats to white people. It was terrible. And all Martin Luther King did was join because he thought that was the right thing to do. Next thing he knew, he was thrown in prison. He hadn't expected that at all. And when they let him out and sent him home, he was so shaken when he got home, he didn't think he could carry on. The minute he got home, the phone rings, and the voice on the other end says, "We don't like you, we don't like what you're doing. If you don't get out of town right now, we'll blow your brains out and blow your house up." Click. A death threat. For a man who had expected to have a quiet life reading books, playing with his kids, looking after his church, it was terrifying. And he realized that if he wanted to carry on, Jesus had to be real to him. So he sat down at the table and said, "God, I believe this cause is right. I believe what we're doing is right. But I'm feeling weak now. I can't do this alone." And he felt God say to him, "Martin Luther King, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world." Martin Luther King never saw his dream becoming a reality. But he went with God, and although many terrible things happened to him after that, and even though he knew that what he was doing would probably cost him his life, he knew that God had promised never to leave him. Now, if God can make that promise to Martin Luther King, and he can do what he did, how can any of us really say, "Well, I don't want to go over to that colleague. It's too big for me. And I'm not really sure God is going to be with me. I think I'll just stay with my boring old spreadsheets." It's an easy thing to say. But surely that means we don't actually believe God when he says, "I am with you always." God says, "I know it's too big for you. I know you can't do it on your own. That's not the point. It's not a plan which will fail if you fail. It's a plan which will succeed because I am with you. And if you really don't want to do it, God will find somebody else." But do you really want to say to God, "Well, I thought as you could find somebody else, I didn't fancy it"? I'll tell you the truth, I don't. Because although I know God can do it without me, it's a wonderful relationship he calls us into. He asks to be in your life, in your heart, in your work, with you in your meals, with you when you sleep, with you when you wake up. That's a relationship I fancy. And I hope it's a relationship you guys want as well. God is calling you to the front line. No matter where you are, no matter what your station, no matter what your job. And he doesn't do it because his plan will fail without you. He does it because he wants to share everything with you. Thank you very much.